Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part one of a rousing talk by activist Vincent Emmanuel. I hope you'll stay tuned. Vincent Emmanuel gave an eye-opening talk in Chicago a few weeks ago. He spoke at the Open University of the Left on September 24, 2016. I confess that the Open University of the Left is new to me, and so is Vincent Emmanuel. I need to do a better job of keeping in touch with the opposition to the establishment. That's not so easy when you're squirreled away in Hartford, Connecticut. Hartford is New England's answer to Lake Wobegon, though with insurance underwriters instead of farmers. I lived in Iowa for 7 years, and I much prefer farmers. No offense to my neighbors in the gray suits. Personally, I think that adding 100 socialist radicals would liven up Hartford considerably. Heck, adding 100 farmers would liven up Hartford considerably. But I digress. Vincent Emmanuel was born into a family of union activists in Chicago. As a young man, right after 9/11, he enlisted in the Marine Corps and served 2 tours of duty in Iraq. That opened his eyes to a few things. He was shocked and dismayed by the brutality and the war crimes he saw committed by the U.S. forces, and he refused to go back for a third deployment. He became active in the Veterans for Peace, became a leader in the Iraq Veterans Against the War, and he participated in the Winter Soldier hearings. He has remained an activist since. We'll hear his Chicago talk, condensed a little by me, this week and next. He starts by discussing the 3 major crises we, the people, are now facing. Crises that are going to produce a most unstable future for us all. Then he talks about what a useful and good grassroots response to these crises would look like. This week in part one, we'll hear Emmanuel's shrewd and scary analysis of the first 2 crises, then the beginning of his analysis of the third. The 3 crises are militarization, social collapse, and ecological disaster. Here is Vincent Emmanuel.
The point isn't to harp on the fact that we're in serious trouble. It's to recognize the very serious and very specific historical context that we're living in today. And the challenges that we face, while some of them are very similar to previous challenges, are also very unique to the time in which we live. So when it comes to U.S. empire, I don't think we really need to go down the list. I'm pretty sure everyone here is pretty familiar with Obama's foreign policy disasters, of course, starting in Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, Libya, Egypt, Syria, Yemen, Ukraine, and the list goes on. That's just in terms of occupation, coups, drone strikes, and so on. We also have, of course, the drone program, estimations of upwards of 4,000 people killed by Obama's drone program, the massive surveillance state, Obama's war on whistleblowers, Cold War 2.0 with Russia, and a whole list of atrocities and brutalities that have been continued from the Bush era into the Obama era over the last 8 years. Now, I don't say that with any pleasure, because as someone who came up through the anti-war movement, it is really a great shame, and it's really sad that we no longer have an anti-war movement in the United States. And I'm sorry, but I would also argue that we maybe never had, at least in my time, an objectively principled anti-war movement. What I came to find from the time I was involved from 2006 to 2008 with the anti-war movement was that it was largely an anti-GOP movement. It was anti-Bush. It wasn't that we were principally against the United States empire, or that we were principally position against U.S. exceptionalism, or that we were opposed to the CIA coups, or so on and so forth, a structural systemic critique that didn't really exist. The majority of the money, the funds, and so on came from sources that were simply interested in demonizing Bush and demonizing the Republicans while giving the Democrats and Obama sort of a clean sheet. And we've seen what the result of that has been. I mean, literally the movements that I worked with for 2 or 3 years of my life, devoting my time from 22 years old to 25 years old, they disintegrated and disappeared almost overnight in 2008 and 2009. I'm going to get back to some of that as well, but I just want to reiterate my own experience here. So the military historian Nick Terse recently wrote, quote, "Last year, according to AFRICOM Commander General David Rodriguez, the U.S. military carried out a total of 546 activities on the African continent. Activities is a catch-all term for everything the U.S. military does in Africa. In other words, it averages about 1.5 missions per day on the continent. This represents a 217% increase in operations, programs, and exercises since the command was established in 2008. That's a 217% increase in U.S. military operations in Africa since Obama has been in office. This is a continent that even those who have been very critical of U.S. militarism haven't focused much of their time on. Most of our time, even those who've remained critical, have been focused on Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, and Libya, to some degree Egypt. As Terse goes on to mention, these exercises include, quote, airstrikes targeting suspected militants, night raids aimed at kidnapping terror suspects, airlifts of French and African troops onto the battlefields of proxy wars, and evacuation operations in destabilized countries. Above all, however, the U.S. military conducts training missions, mentors allies, and funds, equips, and advises its local surrogates. The 18 nations who will be assisting the U.S. AFRICOM command in further military exercises and operations include the U.K., France, the Netherlands, Norway, Denmark, those beautiful Nordic countries, Italy, and Germany, among others. And again, this is really important to keep in mind. Of course, we're focusing on U.S. militarism, imperialism, U.S. empire. But it's not just the U.S. empire who benefits from U.S. imperialism. So if you look at a lot of the contracts that are taking place in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's not in the traditional way simply benefiting U.S. corporations or the U.S. state. As a matter of fact, the majority of large contracts, especially for rare earth mineral extraction in Afghanistan, have gone for Chinese corporations. The same is true in Iraq, but for Japanese corporations. In some ways, the changing coordinates of the geopolitical framework in the world sort of dictate that the United States is the global military force for capitalism, not so much just for the U.S. empire or for the U.S. nation state. Indeed, capitalist countries such as those I just mentioned from Europe, highly advanced, highly developed nations, are benefiting from U.S. imperialism in Africa, but so are developing nations, such as India and China, whose corporations are benefiting from contracts in Afghanistan and Iraq. So let's be clear, it's not just the U.S., though America is the most belligerent of the bunch, no doubt, who is militarizing. As Shanai Shankar writes in International Business Times Online, quote, "India imported more than twice as many weapons in the past 5 years than it did in the previous 5 year span ending in 2009, making it the world's largest buyer of arms currently." Additionally, Shankar notes, quote, "Russia, which reached an initial agreement last month with Egypt for a $2 billion arms deal, accounted for 75% of the arms supplied to India, while the United States supplied a mere 7%. China, being the second largest importer of arms in the world today, has also become a major supplier of arms in South Asia, accounting for 54% of Pakistan's arms imports and 82% of the arms imports in Bangladesh. In the last 5 years, Australia's arms imports have also increased by 83%. In short, the world is militarizing. This is, I think, a really important point that Noam Chomsky made after 9/11. It was a point that I think fell on mute ears at the time because people were so freaked out about what was happening. But the point that Chomsky made was that every state apparatus in the world was going to use 9/11 as an excuse to crack down on their own citizens, their own activists, their own revolutionaries, and also to militarize. More than 15 years later, we see this sort of on a perfect scale. So right now, as we speak, there are also over 30 nations developing drone technology. Now, drones, in my opinion, sort of mark a turning point in the way that we're fighting wars. I think everybody recognizes that when we're using machines with people holed up at a military base in Nevada, eating Cheetos and eating a cheeseburger while launching drone strikes on people in Iraq, significantly changes the landscape of the ways in which we understand wars being fought and the ways that wars are being fought themselves, technically. So right now, as I mentioned, there are 30 other nations that are developing drone technology. This is much like the nuclear weapon in this way. This has started an arms race among nation states where almost every nation in the world now, at least if they're not already building them, are interested in building and using drones. Peter Singer, not the philosopher, but a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute and one of the leading experts on drone technology, I suggest reading his book. I think his book's called Wired for War, talks about autonomous military weapon systems. This is the future of warfare. And as Singer says, he makes an important point when he says, quote, "We're not talking about the how of fighting future wars. That was nuclear weapons. How are we going to fight them? A new weapon here. What we're talking about now is who is going to be fighting wars. And the who in the future will be a combination of human beings and computers, most notably autonomous military robotics technology developed by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So recently there was a study prepared by the U.S. Joint Forces Command, which suggests that by 2025, that's 9 years from now, the U.S. military will have the technology to develop autonomous battlefield robots. Now, we're not talking about drones that take commands from someone sitting in another command center. What we're talking about now in the future, in my lifetime, I'm 32 years old now, so by 2025, I'll be 42 years old, or 41 years old. By the time I'm 41 years old, it is projected that we will have the technology available and the military weapons and capacity available to deploy autonomous battlefield robots. That means that machines will be making the decision whether or not to kill. There won't be someone sitting behind a joystick. This will, of course, be advanced by developments in artificial technology, nanotechnology, biotech, and so on. So even Stephen Hawking has reflected on the future of artificial intelligence, and I don't use these particular sources for any reason other than for the conservatives who might be watching or the liberals who might be watching who are going to ask, who are these crazy sources? I'll use sort of the most standard mainstream sources I can. Stephen Hawking, reflecting on the future of artificial intelligence, this was in an article in The Independent late last year. Quote, "In the near term, world militaries are considering autonomous weapons systems that can choose and eliminate targets. The UN and Human Rights Watch have advocated a treaty banning such weapons. In the medium term, as emphasized by Eric Bjornfsson and Andrew McAfee in The Second Machine Age, artificial intelligence may transform our economy to bring both great wealth and great dislocation. One can imagine such technology outsmarting financial markets, out-inventing human researchers, out-manipulating human leaders, and developing weapons that we human beings cannot even begin to understand. Whereas the short-term impact of artificial intelligence depends on who controls it, the long-term impact depends on whether or not it can be controlled at all." The point here, for regular folks, for people who are involved in building movements and so on, is that this trend either is going to be stopped immediately, and as Hawking mentions, treaties put in place, movements put in place, people, of course, in my opinion, if we don't control at least elements of the state apparatus, then I don't see how the U.S. military, the empire, people within research and development, R&D community, just going to stop on their own. And of course, we know that the United States isn't going to just follow international treaties. So we're going to need an international movement that's capable of stopping these kinds of weapons technology advancements, because this is literally the future of what warfare looks like. So I'm pretty sure everyone here understands the sort of horror show that is domestic American society. From poverty and violence to suicides and drug addiction, the U.S. is a decaying society by most standards. When my friends come and visit from overseas, they are literally blown away. When I take them for walks around Chicago, when I take them to events in Northwest Indiana, they can't believe not only the level of poverty, they can't believe the levels of inequality, and they cannot believe the levels of violence that are taking place here. It's unimaginable and incomprehensible to most people, not only who live in the industrialized world, but even many people who live in developing world, around the world. So according to financial advisory firm Deloitte, income inequality in the U.S. is currently the highest it's been since the 1920s. I don't think that surprises anyone here, but just to run through some of the stats, with 400 American billionaires owning more wealth than 155 million Americans combined, all of this while a third to one-half of Americans live in poverty, depending on what sort of barometers one uses, and another third can barely make ends meet. Microsoft founder Bill Gates leads the list of America's wealthiest with a net worth of $66 billion. What's wild, of course, is that Deloitte's analysis predicts, based on current trends, that U.S. millionaires will see a 225% increase in their wealth by 2020. Accounting for wealth hidden in offshore accounts, they are projected to have over $100 trillion, with a T, in total within the next decade. So it's no surprise, then, that according to a recent Wall Street Journal, quote, over 94% of American millionaires are scared of riots in the streets, unquote. Among industrialized nations, the United States enjoys the highest poverty rate, both generally and for children, the greatest inequality of incomes, the lowest government spending as a percentage of GDP on social programs for the disadvantaged, the lowest number of days of paid holiday, annual leaves, and maternity leaves, the lowest social mobility rate, although now we're the second lowest social mobility rate, right next to England, highest infant mortality rate, the highest prevalence of mental health problems, the highest obesity rate, and the highest consumption of antidepressants per capita. These trends are accompanied by the third shortest life expectancy at birth, the largest international arms sales, the third lowest scores for student performance in math and science, the second highest high school dropout rate, the highest homicide rate, and the largest prison population in the world. Canadian sociologist Maurice Berman, in his book Dark Ages America, notes that, quote, and I think this is very important when we're talking about the alienation of American society, by 2003, that's 2003, mind you, before the Great Recession, the number of Americans who attended even one public meeting at town or school affairs during the previous year was down 40% from what it had been 20 years prior. Additionally, Berman observes that in the mid-1970s, Americans entertained friends at their home on an average of 14 to 15 times per year. By 2006, that number had dropped 50%. While in 2003, 73% of Americans, 73%, stated that most people, including their neighbors, could not be trusted. In 1964, the same survey found that 77% of people interviewed said that their fellow citizens could indeed be trusted. Today, the United States represents 5% of the world's population, yet consumes 50% of the world's pharmaceuticals and 80% of the world's prescription narcotics. Let me say that again. The United States represents 5% of the world's population, yet it consumes 50% of the world's pharmaceuticals and 80% of the world's prescription narcotics. In a county no less than an hour from here, a neighboring county of mine in Indiana, according to the Mental Health and Recovery Services Board, from 2006 to 2014, clients who sought treatment for opium abuse increased 210%. I know at least a handful of people who have died from heroin overdoses. My brother, who's 4 years younger than I, knows maybe a dozen to a dozen and a half people who have died from heroin overdoses. I say those things again because when we talk about American society collapsing, it's not just, oh, there's tons of income inequality. Oh, people can't find jobs. Oh, the education system. No, literally the fabric of life, our ability to hang out with one another, our ability to view our neighbors as citizens and people, friends, potential comrades, people we might want to spend time with and organize or do something important with, is affected not only by the inequality and so on, but by these sort of cultural phenomena as well, this hyper-alienation as a result of extreme individualism, extreme materialism, hyper-consumption, and so on. This is a big part of it. And I think this is really important for people to keep in mind when we're talking about organizing, because we're not talking about organizing the same community or the same society that we were organizing 10, 15, 20, 40, 50 years ago. There have been major changes. Of course, many of those changes have been negative, but I think it's important to keep that in mind. And that level of alienation, I think, might be one of our biggest challenges. I've listened to previous OUL events, and I have friends who have come and given presentations here, people like Kim and Paul Street. You know, one of the things that I'm running into or that I'm encountering is that it's no longer that people don't know that things are screwed up. It's quite the opposite. Majority of people my age or younger that I'm encountering and have encountered for the last 10 years of doing work understand fully that things are screwed up. It's getting them to buy into the idea that they have the power to actually do something about it. Because for years as an activist, I heard people say, oh, Americans are brainwashed morons. They're never going to get it. Don't bother. They're highly propagandized people, and it's never going to happen. And I must say, a lot of my own personal experience of being an activist, it reflected those suggestions. And when we were organizing in 2006, 2007, 2008, people would tell us, it's not that bad, or trying to explain to people that the surge wasn't going to work, that there would be massive blowback from these wars. At the time, people really didn't want to hear it. In the post-2008 world, there's been a much different response. The response now from most of my friends and family and the people we're running into in the streets, knocking on doors, going to events, holding campaigns, and so on, is we're f***ing, and there's nothing we can do about it, so why even bother? That's generally the attitude. So if that's your conclusion, that's fine, but for people who are still interested in organizing, and I'll talk about this after I talk about these ecological statistics and this ecological framework, this framework of ecological collapse, is even in that context, so even if you come to the conclusion that environmentally we can't do much more, and that yes, we've already sort of sealed in certain ecological barometers that will guarantee that 50 to 100 years from now will be a living hell on this planet, from now until then, there will be several things that happen. People will still be living. Communities will still exist. So the point I've been making to people who are saying, well, hey, we're already screwed, all of this is already sealed in fate, so on and so on, is even in the context of collapse, you're going to need cooperation, you're going to need communities, you're going to need to work together, whether that be on a neighborhood level, on the level of your apartment complex, on the level of the block that you live in. If anyone in this room hasn't spent time in failed states, I suggest you do, because even in failed states, people have to organize. And it's not going to be like this is overnight. You know, so like it's not going to be one day everybody wakes up, eats a Snickers bar, watches some Netflix, smokes a pot, and goes to sleep, and then the next day there's nothing. It's going to be slow decline as it's been for many decades here, unless things can be turned around. So it's not going to be, oh, all of a sudden 2025, nobody has water. It's going to be, oh, 2025, we've got 30 million, 40 million refugees from Louisiana, from Mississippi, and Florida who've got to be relocated. How's that going to happen? What are we going to do, put them in internment camps? You think white people in the South are going to be excited to take a bunch of Hispanic and black people from Louisiana and Florida who are going to be refugees? And according to this climate scientist, that's exactly who's going to be the refugees first in this country? No. Those things are going to need to be worked out, and they're going to need to be worked out in a serious fashion over the next 50 years. So talking about the environment, this is not the most positive part of the talk. Some recent reports, I don't even need to read all the details. I'll just skim through this and then we'll get into some of the discussion. I'll get in a little bit of my background, some of the movements I've been working with and some ideas. So the World Wildlife Fund reports that, quote, between 1970 and 2010, populations of mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish around the globe dropped by 52%. That's between 1970 and 2010, we've lost 52% of the mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish around the globe. The biodiversity loss occurs disproportionately in low-income countries and correlates with the increasing resource use of high-income countries. Similarly, a recent headline in Live Science reads, "Most of the world's biggest mammals could be extinct by 2100. A recent story in National Geographic paints an even worse picture for the world's oceans. Quote, "Unless humans act now, seafood may disappear by 2048, concludes the lead author of a new study that paints a more than grim picture for the ocean and human health. The loss of ocean biodiversity is accelerating. 29% of the seafood species humans consume have already crashed. If the long-term trends continue, in 30 years, there will be little to no seafood available for sustainable harvest," unquote. Interestingly, the military is way ahead of the civilian state apparatus when it comes to climate change. A recent Guardian headline from 2 days ago reads, quote, "Military experts say climate change poses the most significant risk to security around the globe. A coalition of 25 prominent members of U.S. national state security community warn that higher temperatures and rising seas will inundate bases," because we have over 1,500 military bases, including in the United States, around the world, "and fuel conflict, not to mention massive migrations on a level unprecedented in human history."
Here we must pause. A fine talk by activist Vincent Emmanuel. Come back next week for more on the ongoing environmental disaster, and then some suggestions for building a better world in response to all three ongoing disasters. Our thanks to Dale Lehman of WZRD in Chicago for supplying the original audio recording, which I have shortened a bit. Thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. Thanks to all the community radio stations who put us on the air, including our home base, station WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. You'll find a free archive of our shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum. An injury to one is an injury to all. War is not healthy for children and other living things. And please come back again next week. Ciao.